Who is Dan Mason? And I was going in concentric circles.
Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education.
Wow, you got some memory.
I guess it's Friday afternoon, and people are moving slowly. The third day of our 3-day legislative committee days.
That'd be deadly.
I think the others will be trickling in, but I'd like to get started. We have a full agenda, very interesting agenda, I think, and I should tell you we have a changed agenda. We've had to move some things around, so we're going to be start. Just to quickly let you know, we're going to be starting with the discussion of achievement compacts, the higher ed achievement compacts. That will come first. Then we will have the report from the Task Force on Higher Education, Student and Institutional Success. Then the progress report on Transfer Student Bill of Rights, and then the Future Connect. And then at the end, the one person I'm sure will be here at the end, myself, will deliver a report to you, an update on how the process of the Special Committee on University Governance is going. Okay, so thank you for your patience, and why don't we move right in to the first item. I'll open an informational hearing on the implementation of achievement compacts. We have Tim Nesbitt from the Governor's Office, Sana Andrews for a bit longer with the Oregon University System, and Bob Davies, depending on how his evaluation goes, for a lot longer at Eastern Oregon.
Tough afternoon.
Welcome to
Yes. This was a topic of conversation at yesterday's meeting of the special committee. So.
Not Bob specifically.
No, yes, okay. Bob specifically.
I have to say, though, I was quoting Representative Lindsay in my comments. I got me in trouble.
Of course. Okay, so Tim, you want to start?
Thank you. Co-Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, manager of the Oregon Education Investment Project for the governor and staff to the Oregon Education Investment Board. I'll start with a update on where the board is in regard to the implementation of achievement compacts. The legislation you passed in the February session, Senate Bill 1581. And just a recap on our purposes here, of course, to create a common focus on key outcomes for our educational institutions, establish a baseline for those outcomes in the 12-13 year, encourage and give to our districts and institutions the mechanism to be budgeting plans, not just planning budgets. In K-12, to comply with the No Child Left Behind waivers requirement for annual measurable objectives. Across all of our institutions, identifying the gap and what it takes to close the gap to get to our 40-40-20 goal by the year 2025. And inform state at the state and the local level the investment decisions we're making so that we have an outcomes focus in how we are using our dollars. You can see in the packet we provided, page 2, a display of how the measures of progress, completion, and connections across the education continuum from early childhood through college and career readiness align across that continuum. And in the intentional alignment, especially in that middle column there, at the point of high school and the completion of high school and the transition for students to community college and universities, that we have common measures in place so that our K-12 districts now, for the first time, are measuring and, as part of the achievement compact, setting targets for college credit in high school, an indicator which is a very strong one for creating a college-going rate and for success in college after high school. And we're tracking as well the experience with enrollment in college after high school. Some of our districts in K-12 have been doing that for some time, but it has been at a cost. They have to contract for that data, and we're doing that now. And you may have seen some early reports which came out of our release of the data for the 9-10 school year, and then soon thereafter, we got the data for the 10-11 school year, and we're able now to show the college going rate from all of our K-12 districts around the state. And that has generated interesting conversations and reports, including one in the Oregonian that you may have read from a student at David Douglas who said, looking at his transcript, I hadn't planned to go to college. I have 8 college credits on my transcript. I'm going. And I think that's really a good validation of how not only does it make it more affordable, accessible, and feasible for students to move on to college when they attain college credit in high school, it does, as I said, make it more affordable and cut the cost of getting to a degree. So we're pleased with how that part is coming together, and you see that our community colleges and university system as well will be tracking how they're doing in enrolling Oregonians from high school and tracking those who arrive with dual credit. So there's an incentive there across the system for the achievement of that of more college credit in high school. We were given a bare outline, a framework in your legislation to translate into these measures in our compacts, and we've done that according to the outline you said here. We've also decided that although the legislation required us in our achievement compacts to require all the districts and institutions to set targets for disadvantaged students as a whole, we ended up at the board deciding it made sense to do that group by group. And so you see next page in behind this table how we have delineated the student groups called underrepresented groups and post-secondary, where the institutions will be tracking, setting targets and tracking results for all those groups of students as well as their students overall. And that will be required anyway in the legislation as to reporting results, so we ended up concluding it made more sense to kind of put that out in the achievement compacts for the setting of targets as well, especially when it's the case that different groups of students may present different challenges and need different strategies to assure their success. So that's how we ended up with a shorter list of measures than we otherwise started out with. And Representative Dembro, and I don't know if there were others of you at the Education Committee meeting 2 days ago, I have to say call your attention to the sample achievement compact in the packet here to say this is the right one. We gave you one version off Monday, and so we'll send that around to the Education Committee members. This is the updated one. It does not include all the measures we debated, and you'll hear from Sana Andrews that there are others which we think deserve more study. And just to start actually with the community college measures, we talked about in our Achievement Compact Subcommittee, chaired by Mary Spilde, with David Reeves and Matt Donegan representing the board as well, and in our advisory committee, which included broad representation from all sectors and interests and stakeholders, that we need to do more study on the GED completers in community colleges. We need to look at community engagement. We had a presentation from a representative of PCC talking about the Sylvania Roots program, professional and personal development, courses of study, affordability, and student debt. All of these issues came up, as well as students, the ratio of students per full-time faculty. So they were part of our discussion. They didn't make it into the first iteration of achievement compacts. We're trying to keep those limited to a manageable number, but we'll continue to discuss these, and more generally, the issues of quality and affordability will continue to be discussed as we look at the results from the first year and look forward to later years of the achievement compacts. In OUS, we had a similar winnowing that we went through from a larger list of measures. We decided not to include the degrees awarded in targeted workforce areas like STEM or the sponsored research expenditures, but you'll hear from Sana that those are being captured in campus compacts between the higher ed board and in individual universities. We also added made some modifications to what came to us from the higher ed board, so we're making sure that we're specific to Oregon freshmen when we talk about high school. We talk about Oregon high schoolers moving on to their freshman year of college or Oregon Community College students transferring in. So we had a back and forth, and it was good that we did. We have another long list here of what's still to be studied and looked at. We had many other measures proposed by the individual institutions, the universities themselves. We left that open in their achievement compacts. They have 3 blank spaces, so to speak, for local priorities, and we expect to hear, as we saw in earlier drafts, perhaps Bob Davies can tell you what they might address in their local priorities. At OSU, we saw that they would like to track ag and forestry degrees as well as other degrees like STEM. There at the U of O, we heard of quality measures related to faculty awards. A number of the universities have wanted to track and probably will offer to track in their optional local priorities patents and licenses for faculty member research dollars and research grants and those other kinds of measures of quality. So next steps at the board meeting on June, I believe it's June 12th, second Tuesday in June, the OEIB will get a report from the National Clearinghouse Higher Education Management Systems, and they're looking at presenting to us an analysis of the path we're on. Given the student enrollments we have now, the experience of the last several years, the levels of funding, the capacity we have, and this will be supplemented by more capacity work being done by OUS, what can we hope to achieve in terms of number of degrees for Oregon residents? What does that first 40 and middle 40 look like? If once we identify the path we're on, how can we best construct a higher trajectory to make more progress and eventually get to our 40-40-20 goals by the year 2025? So this will be ongoing even before we receive the achievement compacts back from the community colleges and universities. That'll happen at the end of June. We'll spend more time analyzing them as well. And under the legislation you approved September 30th, we'll be hearing more recommendations from statewide associations, faculty, and otherwise for how the process can be improved going forward in later years. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have about where we are in the achievement context.
Why don't we hear from the other two panelists, and then we'll ask questions to all of you.
Sana? Great. Representative Dembro, members of the committee, I'm Sana Andrews, and I'm the Vice Chancellor for Academic Strategies with the Oregon University System. And what I'd like to do is just give you a little sense as to how the OUS compacts were created and then how we're using those in various processes that we have at the system level. First of all, it was a very collaborative process. We submitted eight compacts to the OEIB, one for each of our institutions, and then one for OUS. The idea being that the institutional compacts would roll up to then represent the OUS totals, but that we needed to have one for the system so that what we could be doing is looking at this statewide. The compacts are identical. The system and the institutional compacts are identical at this time, with the exception of Oregon State. And Oregon State has an additional measure that focuses on extension. Our intent is, however, to have these local priorities, and the institutions actually did develop local priorities in the process that are very mission-specific. This was driven by some work that's been going on for about 2 years at OUS, where what we're doing is looking at our mission alignment and what each institution offers. And so it might be, and Bob Davies will talk about this, that Eastern will have a different measure than University of Oregon would have on a particular aspect of how they deliver their mission. But they have a common set of measures, and then there will be these local measures. The other thing I think that's important to realize in these is that there were some measures, as Tim Nesbitt mentioned, that we did have initially in our compacts, and then we streamlined them for the OEIB. Those are still measures that we will use at the system level, and they include targeted degrees, specifically in STEM, health professions, and STEM education. And then also research, in terms of research and expenditures and economic development. So those are things that we will continue to track and that our board will use in terms of performance measures for our institutions. The other thing that we're doing is we're actually in the process of doing some capacity modeling. The achievement compacts ask for us to articulate targets, and targets in some very specific areas in terms of the measures that are in there. One of the things that OUS is doing is trying to determine how are we going to be able to meet the 40-40-20 goals. What's the capacity we have? Where are there gaps where we don't have the capacity? And that will be different for each of our institutions. So we are engaged in that process right now as well. The process was very collaborative. We spent quite a bit of time working with our institutions and our board and the system office. And so what was presented to the OEIB were compacts that everyone within the system agreed would be good measures in which we could demonstrate how we're meeting the 40-40-20 goals. So with that, I will turn it over to President Davies.
Thank you. And for the record, well, first of all, thank you, Chairperson Denbrough, for inviting me back for an encore showing from yesterday, and also members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Davies. I'm the president of Eastern Oregon University in LeGrand, and hopefully will be a president for a very long time. You're making me nervous now, Chairperson Denbrough. As I discussed yesterday with the Special Task Force and Joint Committee on University Governance, as a public university, we serve at the pleasure of the state, and our goal is to meet statewide goals and objectives. As a recipient of state funding, regardless of how much or how little, we are duty-bound to honor and adhere to the goals and objectives that the citizens set forward. And as representative electives of those citizens, it is your goals and ambitions that we strive to meet. Also in the discussing yesterday the role of governing boards, there was a book, and I know how much Representative Lindsay likes reading the various books on higher education. A book was just published from the Harvard Press called Financing American Higher Education in the Era of Globalization. The author's research points to five factors that have profound impact and on outcomes such as student preparation for college, participation and completion rates, and research activity. Of those five, three are directly related to compacts. Those three that directly relate to the compacts include states that develop clear public goals and priorities for higher education and pursue them through consistent and intentional strategies will see profound improved performance. 40-40-20 is a great example. States that lack a strong interface agency between higher education institutions and the state government and their priorities are a significant disadvantage in achieving those statewide goals. The achievement compacts, again, fit right into that mode. And then also the ability of the state government through a statewide board or other mechanisms to improve missions and thus prevent mission creep and have mechanisms for accountability will produce higher results. Those three are directly related to the achievement compacts. So again, from a statewide perspective, I think it is absolutely essential that we continue to move forward with that and have that statewide approach. From an institutional perspective, the achievement compacts are very important to my role as president in leading our university. For one, it does provide that direct statewide connection. We are able to point to our compact and its relationship with the other seven or the other six public universities, as well as the community colleges that we work with, to show how we impact the results of the achievement of the 40-40-20 and how our efforts go to that area. I also appreciate the fact that there's one compact going to the statewide level. I think that's very important because, again, it's that direct connection. And because we have the special contacts, compacts with the state system, it allows us to have that unique nature that fits our own mission, our own element to the state system. And at that state system level, they can evaluate and help us evaluate how that is achieving the overall statewide goals in direct and indirect ways. Furthermore, when it comes to budgeting, to strategic planning, to setting priorities and programs for our university, the compacts allow us to have a discussion point that creates an open and transparent process throughout our campus and throughout our region. So again, all of these things are added up into a model that allows us to operate very effectively and efficiently. With regards to the specific elements of our statewide or of our compact with the system, we have, as part of that, our commitment to the Eastern Promise, which I think many of you may know about, is our connection directly with K through 12, specifically from the 5th grade to the 12th grade, in providing opportunities and a pipeline for our young sons and daughters to be moving from elementary school to middle school with an eye towards college, and then even in high school, planning their courses, planning their curriculum to go on to the college area. I must say that I'm very proud that on Monday, holiday night. I was part of a graduation ceremony for eighth graders from the Four Rivers Community, from the Four Rivers Charter School, which in, we handed out scholarships to those eighth graders for Eastern Oregon University. And I don't know if you know about the Four Rivers Community, our charter school. It's something that I would encourage you to look into. Many of those students entered kindergarten only able to speak Spanish. Now they speak proficient, obviously, Spanish, but as well, and English. They are going into the high school system now very, very well prepared. And in fact, with the Spanish courses that they've taken, they've already earned a minor in Spanish at most community colleges. Think about that. And it's absolutely amazing. And then to talk to the parents of the sons and daughters and have them translate, because mom and dad do not speak English, that they're translate, that they will go to college, that they have the means and the necessary to make a success, is a very important statement. That is part of our compact. Second part of our compact is distance education, leveraging technology. Right now at Eastern Oregon University, over half of our students will not set foot on our campus until the day they graduate. Over half. Over half of our credits are now earned through online programs and distance programs. So again, that's a very, very important part of the culture of Eastern Oregon University, and we have built that into our compact. And then finally, we have earmarked some special degrees that serve the region: business, education, and anthropology, sociology. Might be a little bit surprised about the last one. The reason that that's part of our special mix is it's completely encapsulated online. It is also one of the degrees that is preferred by most of the agencies that hire our students in Eastern Oregon because of the learning and the techniques that they learn through that, and the research that they learn through that process. The final part of our special niche compact is our economic connections to the region. This is through the Regional Solutions Center. That is a proposal that we've implemented at Eastern Oregon University, and the number of internships and the number of programs that they will undertake, both in terms of direct application of research and also the basic research. So again, the compacts allowed us to focus our efforts into those areas. It is something that I think is very important for us to move forward with. I think it's important that we concentrate on the statewide goals coming from the system, but we also have a very robust system for each university to have their own niches through the state system. So with that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you may have for the interview.
Okay, committee members, I'll open it up to questions now. Before we do that, though, I do want to say, I mentioned that Sana's time with the OUS is short, but she's not moving that far. She's moving to be the provost at Portland State University, so we'll still get to work with her and have the quality of her expertise.
Representative Denver, I'm glad you cleared that up for the record. People might have thought I was fired from my position, as opposed to what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I'm sure people are just turning in. New newspaper articles will be going out.
So. Okay, questions, members. Rich, Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So thank you, by the way, for coming down. And President Davis, thanks for always traveling so far to be with us and educating us.
My pleasure.
As I sit here and think a little bit deeper on the purpose of the achievement compacts and 40-40-20, the public policy purpose behind that, I think, is that we want more education so that we have stronger families, so that we have stronger people that make stronger commitments, so we have more prosperity, etc. I assume that's the public purpose there. But then my next question is well, it's kind of a cause and effect question, and that is, do some sectors of our society have stronger values, stronger commitments, stronger families because they are more educated and because they are more prosperous? Or are they more educated and more prosperous because they have strong families, they come from stronger commitments? My gut impression is that it's the latter. Is that we have more educated people, that we have more prosperous people when they come from these strong families, as vice versa. And I'm wondering if, I guess I'm just thinking out loud here, in all of our thinking we ought to, actually maybe it's both really, because a lot of people come from very bad situations and they just are amazing. But I'd say the great majority come from those institutions. But I say that we got to balance this between sort of focusing on the strong families so that they're more educated, but then we're also focusing on the strong education. So it's a teeter-totter.
I think that, pardon the pun and the joke, but not to sound like a politician, the answer to your question is yes. I think it's both. I think that when you look at the fundamental basis of higher education in the United States and the system, and not the OUS system, but the system of public higher education in the United States, it is based on a fundamental belief that a college degree, any sort of education, but specifically a college degree and an advanced degree, is the socioeconomic status mobilizer. It allows individuals to transform from one socioeconomic status to another. It allows an individual to transform from one level of economic disdain and issues to another. It allows individuals to mobilize across sectors. In the 1960s, the Truman Report is the basis of many of those discussions and why we started as a country on the massification of higher education, in that we purposely, as a country and as a state of Oregon, said that higher education must be accessible to all because of not only the private goods, the better job, but also because of the public goods that it brings. And so I think that you're absolutely right. When students young men and women are raised in a family in which both mom and dad have a college degree, and talk about college, and the question does not become, if you go to college, it is which college you will go to, that makes a significant difference in that attitude. But there's also a whole, and so there's an element there where they're already on that mobilization, that they are going to achieve more than their fathers and mothers and be able to, again, extend out. But there's a whole other cadre of our citizens that colleges, who knows? It's something for the other person. It's someone from outside. It's someone from a totally different area. And it's programs like the Eastern Promise. It's the programs that I mentioned with the Fort Rivers Charter School that will enable those individuals to mobilize and to seek greater good, both publicly and privately. They will be able to transform themselves and achieve greater goods in their private life, a better job, more likely to be hired, a better salary, all those different types of things. But it's also the public good. Those individuals that have a college degree are more likely to vote. They're more likely to be volunteers at an organization. They're more likely to give blood. They're more likely to coach Little League and other types of activities. It's just one of those things that's been proven time and time again. And again, and even controlling for what their background from, we're seeing significant differences in those individuals that are able to at least go to 1 or 2 years of a college and have that profound impact. There's a great deal of research from Professor Aston out of the University of Southern California that really alludes to that. That even 2 semesters of a college enables them to start that transformation. So it is, the answer is yes.
Representative Dembro and Representative Lindsay, could I just do a little follow-up on that? I'm so glad you asked the question because it allows us to put on the table the affordability issue, which is the biggest driver influencing whether or not individuals go on to post-secondary education. And so I think that that's an important factor, as well as some of these pre-college programs that get students thinking about college early.
Just to follow up.
Okay, Rip.
I don't know what the statistics are, and I think I agree with you, but I'd say that probably the number one indicator would be the socioeconomic status of that person from where they're coming from, their family. If they come from a severely broken home, extreme poverty, that's probably going to be more of an indicator than the affordability, although I acknowledge the affordability is huge there. But I guess that's what I wanted to paint here is that, yes, education, more education brings prosperity and stability, but also we ought to make sure we're very much paying attention to the stability of families because that's where it's the other role as well. And we need to, from very basic on down, we need to make sure we're always stabilizing family commitments and all that and making sure that parents aren't checking out on kids, and that helps get more there.
I think that's a good point. I do think that higher levels of education do promote family stability. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of evidence for that. Yep. But Rep Hunt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about college credit accumulation. I had a disturbing experience last night. My son and I were with probably 500 other parents at a college fair in Portland. Five universities, all private, all not Oregon. Several questions from the students about college credit. You know, I've taken these AP classes. I've taken this community college credit. How's that going to apply? How's that going to save me money in college? How's that going to kind of enable me to go through college faster? And all five university representatives pretty much said, they gave the exact counter message that we've been sending. And basically said, at our five schools, again, all non-Oregon, all private, it's not going to help you. We want you to stay all 4 years. You can place into a higher level, of course, to start with, instead of starting at an entry level. But we've been working so hard at trying to integrate the K-12 community college university messaging around accumulate credit, earned it in high school. It's all an upside. It'll save you money. It'll make you go through faster. And I was really struck, and I think these students who were asking the questions were struck, by getting the exact opposite message from these universities. And I don't know if that's something, it got me wondering about the private colleges even in Oregon, if they're sending that kind of counter message as well. They weren't represented there last night, but
I don't believe.
And any thoughts about how much of a problem that is, and if there's any way to better integrate?
Well, Coach Dembro and Representative Hunt, and I'll let President Davies speak probably with more specificity, but that's exactly why we need the coordinated system that you've asked us to develop in Senate Bill 909 and the subsequent legislation. We need that coordination between our K-12 districts and our community colleges and universities. I think our practice and experience over the last several years with our Oregon Transfer Module and the better articulation of our programs and the Eastern Promise, even the best example of all, shows what we can accomplish by bringing more college-level work into the high schools, and shows, I would challenge those representatives of universities from outside the state to look again at the data about student success, because it's students who have achieved some level of college credit in high school who are more likely to go to college and more likely to succeed and more likely to get to their degrees on time in 4 years for a four-year degree. So it's all, that's the upside, and I think that's why we have a system, that we can make that a priority and as a system coordinate our efforts to get there.
Obviously, I can't speak specifically to those particular private universities. But what I can say is that there is ample research that demonstrates clearly that if individuals are able to obtain college credit in their high school, that the likelihood of going to college, the likelihood of succeeding, meaning a degree, the likelihood of the college experience being positive in retrospect is significant. And also to Representative Lindsay's question about reaching into those areas where mom and dad aren't necessarily either together or not from a college-going culture themselves, one of the biggest fears that these young men and women have is that they will not be able to be successful, that they will not be able to compete at the college level, and so why enter a fight that they think that they're going to lose from the get-go? And so having the dual credit, having the Eastern Promise specifically, which I think is better than some of the dual credit options, because it is a college course at the high school level, or in the high school, so they're taking college work, and they're seeing themselves be successful, I think is very much important. I would guess that depending upon some of the colleges that may have been there last night that you were referring to, have a definite system and a definite methodology to their rankings and to their efforts. That freshmen come in and they're freshmen and they're going to have 150 freshman students, and they're going to take all those classes together, and then they're going to become sophomores, and they're going to be doing all the same things, and they lump through. And so anything that would disrupt that system is something that they're not necessarily going to be embracing. That's not a, that is not to say that, that that's a bad thing. That's their minds. That's their mindset, and it's a very positive mindset. And Princeton does that, and they're not a bad university. And so I think that there are some advantages to that. And in Truth in Advertising, here's my concern. With the Eastern Promise being widely successful, we will have students entering Eastern Oregon University at the age of 18, 19, and being late sophomores, early juniors. That means they're going to graduate much earlier, which in one hand is a very good thing. But maturity levels, socialization, those type of things, that's what gives me pause, to be honest. How do we make sure that we don't allow, in my case, my 11-year-old daughter to become too old too fast and leave me too soon? And so, you know, one of the concerns I have is that socialization that college does in fact bring, and I don't want to necessarily lose that.
Let me just add to that that, you know, I think that, you know, the concern that, that Representative Hunt brings is something that, you know, I would hate to see be true here in Oregon. I mean, I think it's really important that Oregon's independent colleges are working closely with our the efforts of the investment board and all of us. And I think that's one reason that as we created the legislation that creates the HEC, the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, you know, we envisioned, you know, a strong presence for the independent colleges at that table, you know, just to make sure that there is that coordination. So if, you know, at least if a student chooses to stay in Oregon, they can feel pretty secure that those credits are going to be accepted and help them to get through.
Chairperson Denbrough, let me add, as I mentioned in my opening comments, that there were five factors or five points that the authors of the book that I mentioned discussed about improving success of college completion, college readiness, and whatnot. The fifth point, which I did not mention, is right on this point, the inclusion of private universities in the public policy discussion and a portfolio in the portfolio of those discussions will improve performance. So to your point, exactly, including the private colleges, the independent colleges in these discussions and ensuring the ultimate success of that is critical to the overall achievement of 40-40-20.
Okay, thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And, great presentation, thank you. So I've been sitting here thinking a little bit, and I'm going to try to pull a question out of this. So Eastern Oregon's near and dear to my heart. You lived in John Day many years ago. And it's difficult for kids over there, or it was then. It's easier now, but it was very difficult for kids not only to get to college, to see themselves getting to college. And part of that, for good or bad, was the timber industry. So maybe that thwarted that. Maybe that helped that. I don't know. But that's not present now over there. So as we're talking about 40-40-20 and that being a goal, and I love the East, I've heard about it before, the Eastern Promise program, and to have fifth graders having that conversation. It's just incredible. I think that's wonderful. And you talked about some of the main degree programs that you have. So as I sat here and I looking through this through the lens of 40-40-20, what it means to Eastern Oregon, where people are going to be employed when they graduate, and a couple thoughts came to mind. The job market's not great, and the biggest, unless it's changed a lot, one of the biggest employers over there is federal government, BLM, Forest Service, and so I guess the question would come down to roughly, and I've put you on the spot here, I acknowledge that, what percentage of your students are staying over there, completing, staying over there, getting jobs over there? Talk to me a little bit about that, because I'm trying to see how 40-40-20 fits in Eastern Oregon University and Eastern Oregon.
Sure. I think you hit some key points. The Eastern Promise is a push strategy. We are pushing the higher education agenda, if you want to call it that, and aggressively pushing that. But what is the full strategy? How do I, as a junior in high school, view my prospects that if I want to come back, I will point to 2.5 years ago when I went to Pilot Rock High School. And I have to say that one of the things I really enjoy is going to the area high schools and talking to them. And I was actually in John Day about 3 weeks ago. I went to Dayville and all points in between. Went to Monument and Troy. And Monument, I will say that I'm very proud that we have the valedictorian, the salutatorian, and the number three, four, and five graduates from Monument coming to Eastern Oregon University. The sixth graduate is going
to... That's all of the graduates.
No, there's one more.
They don't have football teams at those schools without joining forces.
That's what I was going to say. But the last one is going into the military, so we're doing well. We convinced one to... was going to go to Portland State, but now is going to Eastern, but I will tell the future provost that. But what is the pull strategy? And I was in Pilot Rock about 2.5 years ago talking about college. And a young man raised his hand and said, why in the world do I want to go to college? I'm going to go work at the mill. My dad worked at the mill. My grandfather worked at the mill. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to marry Susie. And my goal right now is to buy a Ford F-250. And... we talked about, we had a side conversation about that, and he was also thinking about dropping out of college, or dropping out of Pilot Rock, and we talked about, that's a nice short-term plan, but what's the long-term? What about not just working at the mill, what about managing the mill? What about providing for the son or daughter that you want Susie to have? What about providing the opportunities for your community to come back and be better? It's not all about the job, but what about the other opportunities that you may have? I'm very pleased to say that I received a note from this young man back in January inviting me to be the commencement speaker to hand him his diploma, and at the same time I signed his acceptance letter to Eastern. So we were able to convince one person to make that shift. But you're absolutely right. What is that pull strategy? The Regional Solution Center is something that we're moving forward on at Eastern, more so than I think at other places, because we have to find jobs and opportunities for those students to move into. 40% of the workforce in Eastern Oregon is government employees, either state or federal. 40%. We right now in Union County have a 10.4% unemployment rate. In Wallowa County, it's nearly 15%. And we have to find ways of economic development for those opportunities to have that pool. The Regional Solution Centers at Eastern, through the efforts of the governor, is providing some of those opportunities in finding new opportunities for new businesses to develop, for marketing plans and those type of things. But we have a long way to go. One of the things that I think we should be looking at are where are incentives based, how do we help the local town, there are 99 cities in Eastern Oregon, believe it or not. Only four of them have their master plans up to date. Only four of them, because of that, can aggressively recruit businesses. Through the Regional Solutions Center, we have 17 interns going throughout the entire state from our public administration policy, helping those towns get their master plans up to date so that they can start recruiting more and more businesses. We've got a long way to go, but we need to aggressively find those incentives. Representative Springer, you did not put me in the spot. There are a few things that keep me up at night. And that pull strategy, that economic development part, is a critical link to the success of 40-40-20, to the success of this state as a whole.
Thank you,
President. I have a couple of questions myself. And, you know, we've talked about the affordability question. And, you know, one of the, Tim, you had mentioned that in future compacts you would like to see something about student debt. Debt loads as part of the compacts, and I would really encourage that. I wish that they were in even this first iteration something about that. You know, as this committee heard from Jay Kenton back in during the February session, that the you know, if you look at the cost per student at the institutions, It's remained relatively flat over the last 15 years, adjusted for inflation. Because of the decline in state resources and the increase in the number of students, that has translated to higher and higher tuition for students. We did Joe Holliday shared with us some data about debt loads for the OUS schools, and committee, you have this at the dais, and it shows that the average debt load for OUS is $22,000. Eastern Oregon, for some reason, has kept theirs at $17,700, and at some point I'd like to find out why. But, you know, I think that is one of the, that sort of exemplifies one of the goals of the achievement compacts, is that we see how different institutions are performing on different indices, and, you know, to try to understand why is the debt load lower at this school, higher at this school. You know, the highest is Portland State at 26,000, and U of O at about 20,000, 21,000. So what exactly is going on? You know, I think that's information that would be useful to us in the future. So I do hope we can get that.
Yes, and Co-Chair Dembro, I would expand on that. I can't commit to how the board will decide to tackle that and resolve that as an achievement compact issue, but it is an issue. And I think we can learn even more from correlating debt loads to completion rates and success overall. I mean, think of, as challenging as those debt loads are, think of a student who leaves after 2 or 3 years, doesn't get his or her degree, and has a debt load. So that's a concern as well. I think we need to connect all those dots and learn from the correlations that may exist, so that can also feed into what is going to be most effective in getting students through to completion. Again, our 40-40-20 goal.
Great, thank you. The other question that I have is around graduate programs. I mean, the achievement compacts right now, you know, really focus on undergraduate, and you know, I think that's probably tied to the goal of the 40-40-20, which is, you know, really more undergraduate focused. But do you see at some point us doing more with graduate and the research component of the universities as well?
Representative Dembro, members of the committee, we do have, in fact, as one of our measures, the number of advanced degrees awarded. That would include both master's and doctoral degrees. The thing about the achievement compacts is they're speaking directly to 40-40-20, and the way that the legislation is written is it's 40% with a bachelor's degree or higher. Presumably when someone gets a master's or a doctoral degree, they already have a bachelor's degree, so they're in that count. But that is in there. It's important to our OUS institutions, especially those institutions that have graduate programs and master's doctoral programs. And then the research piece is something that is important to OUS as well. And that really is linked very closely to the graduate programs in terms of the kinds of specializations that we have and all. So very important to OUS, different for different institutions. So, for example, you might see Eastern's contribution to that being less than Oregon State's, but you might see Eastern contributing more to the number of rural degrees offered to at the bachelor's level.
Thank you. Other questions, colleagues? Okay, panel, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That's great. Okay, I'm going to close the information hearing on the achievement compacts, and we'll now move to a report from the Task Force on Higher Ed Student and Institutional Success.
Yeah. Mr. Co-Chair, I just wanted to let you know, unfortunately, I have another commitment today, so I don't want anybody to think I'm leaving because it's not riveting conversation, but I'll be leaving here in a little bit.
Thank you. Okay. These are two familiar faces to the committee. We heard a report from these two individuals. When was it? Back in January?
January, I believe. Yeah.
Welcome again.
Thank you very much, Chair Dembrough and committee members. We welcome the opportunity to update you on our work. You, as Chairperson Dembrough has indicated, you received the Ben and Ed team again, and we work well together. He's a fine young man, and I would go anywhere with him.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Yes,
please?
My name is Ed Dodson. I'm chairman, or I'm a board member at Chemeketa, and also I'm the president of OCCA this year. And this is Ben Eckstein, a freshman or a senior from the University of Oregon, who is shortly going to graduate.
Hello. Thank you.
We have shared with you work earlier and shared with you that we have identified strategies or barriers to students in higher education, and also some strategies that we worked with, and we'd like to update you on that work at this time. In our last agenda, or our last meeting last week, in fact, on Wednesday of last week, we started off with a conversation with Ben Cannon, in which he shared some ideas and thoughts about the planning that's going on to plan for the budgets, the 10-year budget for education and achieving the 40-40-20. It was a really good exchange of information. We shared some thoughts and promised him a letter and some information on the barriers, and have completed that work, and I believe you either have it or will have it shortly at hand. We then moved into a discussion of the significant barriers, what has been known now to us as big rocks, the barriers to kids being successful, students, learners being successful. In February and March, the task force reduced the barriers from 12 or 13 to a more manageable 3 to 5. But it was really interesting, in the meeting this last week, we got a little pushback from some members who felt that some of the barriers that they felt were big rocks had not been included. And so we had a conversation about that, and finally came to the decision or conclusion that we felt it was important to stay with those that the entire committee identified as the big rocks, the big barriers, but that we also thought in the final report there will probably be an identification of those others that were there, not because we believe we need to focus on those as the total, but we want it known that there are institutions or individuals that believe those are areas that need to be looked at, and so those will be part of the report. Not a minority report, but an identification of some areas that are important. We had discussion and made decisions to stick with those that were the most significant, and the barriers that we have identified that we wish to work hardest on, or to give the focus in our report and have the legislature work with, are lack of funding, which is really the fundamental big rock. If you think about achieving 40-40-20, when our funding is in the lowest 20% of the states in the country, we have some tough work ahead of us. So we need to get that. That is an absolutely foundation barrier for us. We also identified poor management of transitions, be that transitions from high school to community college, from community college on to four-year, or the reverse transfer kinds of things that we're working on now. Also identified insufficient support for underrepresented communities. Insufficient number of full-time faculty. and limited support of services such as advising and tutoring. We then moved into looking at those barriers in terms of strategies and identified and discussed criteria to assess those strategies, and Ben will share some information with you regarding that.
Thank you. So at our last meeting, as we moved from solidifying the barriers that we wanted to focus on into now looking at strategies that we can identify and recommend, we had a discussion about the criteria that we want to use as a task force in the recommendations we make for strategies. And so you can see on this list of about 7 or 8 criteria that we identified after our discussion, and some examples that I would highlight. Is it a cost-effective return on investment? So looking at strategies that actually make sense to invest in and give back, based on the amount that they require. Is it adaptable and scalable? So we wanted to get an idea of strategies that might be in place now at one institution that can be adapted to another institution, or strategies that might be that could be expanded, so can it be scaled, and is it sustainable? And so this one really gets at, looking at strategies that are realistic and that we can realistically implement. Will it contribute to reaching achievement compact targets in 40-40-20? We think this is a really important criteria given the direction our state is moving in and the importance of these goals. So we identified those criteria to frame the work that we do as we move forward and actually identifying the strategies that we want to recommend to the legislature. So we at our last meeting, we had some sample strategies presented to us in 2 different categories. So the first category was actions that are currently being undertaken to address barriers, and institutions across the university system as well as community colleges were asked to submit a couple of samples each on strategies that they are using right now to address some of the barriers that we had identified. And so we included some examples, and just as a couple to highlight, for instance, insufficient funding and a limited ability to pay being one of the main barriers. And so one strategy that was submitted was the University of Oregon identified the Pathway Oregon program, and Oregon State University, a similar program, Bridge to Success, as programs that use funding to cover tuition and other costs for Pell-eligible students. And then Pathway Oregon at the U of O also provides intensive advising and other support services. So an example of a strategy that's really addressing low socioeconomic status students and their ability to access a higher education. Another example, poor management of transitions was an important barrier, and Shemeketa Community College submitted a sample strategy, Creating College Success, which is a course that they offer to students to help them transition from high school into community college. So those are some examples, and we had an extensive list that will be narrowed down, but these are some examples of strategies that are currently being undertaken that have been submitted to us as samples. And then the second category that we looked at were strategies that institutions believe can address the barriers but that are not in place currently or need to be expanded. And so some examples, in limited support services such as advising and tutoring, PSU had submitted Complete College Now, which would implement prescriptive degree maps, degree map milestones, and provide extra advising and tutoring to their students. Another sample strategy that was submitted from Lynn Benton Community College, Shemeketa Community College, for insufficient support for career and technical education programs, ramping up its career center, focusing on CTE information, completion, referral, and job development services. So again, these are strategies that were submitted to us from across the state as examples of strategies that institutions would like to put in place to address these barriers, but that are not currently in place. And then another area of discussion that the task force has identified over the course of the last couple to several meetings has been looking really closely at the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program and OSAC. And so at our last 2 meetings, we've invited the executive director of OSAC to discuss with us the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program and to answer questions about how that program fits in to the 40-40-20 goal and to a lot of the conversations we're having. So we've asked how the current implementation of of the Opportunity Grant contributes to the 40-40-20 goal. And in our discussion on the task force, we've really identified this shift from access to completion in terms of the way that we're looking at the goals that we've set as a state. And OSAC has primarily focused on access, you know, getting students in the door. And so as we're looking at 40-40-20 and the work we're doing, we've really tried to talk about how can OSAC impact completion as well in getting students out the door. Over time, the Opportunity Grant Program, which originated as a flat grant program, shifted to the shared responsibility model, and now due to funding has really shifted back to a flat grant model because of limited funding. And so these changes in how they're modeling the grant have not been connected to outcomes yet. So that's something else that we've discussed as a task force, is how can we connect what OSAC is doing with the Opportunity Grant to outcomes. And if funding were to increase for student assistance, what would be the best way to use those funds to connect them with those outcomes? And so we've talked about, you know, for example, a commitment to continuing awards for students who receive it 1 year, so that we can actually promote completion, that students know that they'll have an award for the duration of their education. And we've discussed other strategies along those lines, but again, trying to connect the Opportunity Grant Program and the access goals to completion in 40-40-20.
And then let me interrupt you. Colleagues, we had actually hoped to have had a discussion of OSAC today and the shared responsibility model and the future of need-based assistance here in the state, but the OSAC director was not available today. So we'll be doing that at our September legislative committee days, and really, you know, want to get into this, you know, drill into this subject of need-based aid.
Thank you. Yeah, and we have on the Opportunity Grant issue, the task force did decide to form a subgroup as well to continue having some of these conversations because of its importance to the access and affordability issue.
That kind of brings us then to the work that's ahead of us. We've done some good work. We've enjoyed that work, but there's still a lot to be done. We've moved through narrowing or winnowing the barriers down. As I said in February, we've worked with strategies to the barriers. We will further be doing that through July. We will be examining methods for students to acquire basic skills. We'll be doing that May through July. June through July, we will be assessing strategies and developing alternative funding options that could possibly be applied to the 40-40-20. And then in October, we will submit a final report to the legislature for your consideration. And that will, at that point, have completed our work, but I'm sure would be willing to and glad to go beyond that if necessary.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Colleagues, questions? I one, it's actually, it's not a question so much as a comment, and it goes back to that question of finding strategies that are not only, you know, creative and potentially effective, but also sustainable. You know, I think that many of the programs that that have been submitted by the institutions as examples of what they're doing to promote student success are being funded, you know, through special grants or are pilot projects of various sorts. And the question is going to become, you know, how in an era of, you know, continued declining resources or at least inadequate resources, how can we make those programs, once they've proven their effectiveness, sustainable? I mean, how does that happen?
I think I can speak at least to the community colleges, and they will continue to look for grants, and they will continue to look for that kind of revenue. They will look to their foundations, because those methods and approaches are working, and so, you know, it's that or cut into other program to do that, and we just about are to the end of that with our revenue. Ben, thoughts on
Yeah, Representative Dembro, members of the committee. I would also add that I think that's a big part of the reason that we had identified funding as a foundational barrier that really covers all of these areas, because I do think that sustainability is directly connected to funding, and that a lot of these strategies really won't be sustainable if the funding piece is not in place.
Okay, well, thank you for the briefing, and, Representative Greenlee.
Thank you. I voted against the higher-end budget every time for the last five sessions because I think it's inadequate, so I'm perfectly willing to stipulate the funding's inadequate. I've had three emails today telling me that K-12 education is inadequate because it's $3 billion short. I just don't know where we're going with that. So maybe the answer is simply to give up, stop pretending that we have aspirational goals and that we're going to be a mediocre state, and we can test the hypothesis that having less educated kids than their parents will make stronger families.
It's not my hypothesis.
Exactly.
No.
The point is, I don't know what to do with that information. I guess I share this. I agree. If we're not going to fund higher education, we're not going to do the job. And yet,
we don't.
I've only been here 10 years, and it's gotten worse over the time that I've been here. And it's not very reassuring to have that answer, which I know is true.
It's a tough battle.
Mm-hmm. It is the challenge with the achievement compacts, right? That the compact is between the state and the institutions, and I know people are working very hard in all the institutions to make do with what are essentially inadequate funds being given by the state. And what is the state's responsibility in the compacts? That's something I think we all have to struggle with. But I just want to say I really appreciate the work that's being done. And people are working tirelessly in the field to try to keep this system together. I certainly share the good representative's despair or pessimism about it.
Frustration.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Rep. Lindsay.
Thank you. Just a question, and that is, I agree there's inadequacies, and we always hear there's not enough, but the answer that I never get is, what is? What would be adequate? Do we have a percentage? Do you have a percentage? Do you have a hard number of what would be adequate in your specific realm? So we have something to march toward.
Representative Lindsay, members of the committee, I don't think that we've come up with a specific percentage, and I wouldn't want to speak for the task force.
Exactly.
I can say that in our conversations around the Opportunity Grant, for example, we have been presented with information in response to our questions from OSAC about, what levels of funding would it take to fully fund, for example, the shared responsibility model. And we've seen data on the gap in a student's ability to pay, 10 years ago versus their ability to pay today and the gap now. So, I do think there are ways to quantify, at least from an access and affordability standpoint, when we're talking about the barrier of a limited ability to pay for students, we can quantify to a degree how much funding it would take to fill that gap. But I don't know that we have, as a task force, a number or percent, other than the work the conversations we've had on the Opportunity Grant for what that amount would be.
Representative Lindsay, we have seen at community colleges, we've seen far more. Much of this work that Ben described for you this afternoon was in place, was in planning and in place before this came from in terms of the task force or the legislation. And they did that by, I've been amazed as to watch their budgets drop from year to year since 99. Watch them reorganize and regroup and continue to be successful. So it makes it hard to know how much it would be, but I also know that we are to an end of very much more creativity. And I think gains in these areas now will be made by some cuts that maybe are more harmful than we're after. So again, I agree with Ben. I don't know what the percentage is, but I also do know that any will be appreciated very much and will be applied highly and successfully.
And Representative Lindsay, members of the committee, if I could add as well, just to kind of illustrate some of the conversations we've had with regard to that question, we, at our last task force meeting, we saw figures on the current funding levels for OSAC of a little over $100 million per biennium, I think. And one of the questions we asked was, how much funding would it take to fully fund the shared responsibility model, including the debt assumptions that are already in place? So it doesn't even fully fund the gap, and the answer was $350 million annually, so $700 million in a biennium. So just to give an idea of the scale of the gap right now that exists, and again, that's even that amount would not cover the full need of Oregon students because of the debt assumptions that are in place. So I think that illustrates one of the reasons why funding and limited ability to pay were a foundational barrier that we identified.
Thanks. And just to come up, Mr. Chair, is that I believe that our to service our debt this biennium is $940 million. So I think that that's $750 million there that you just mentioned. We could get rid of some of that debt, and we could put that there.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we might consider a principle of spending as much on higher ed as we spend on prisons. Sort of peg the higher ed budget to the prison budget might be.
Well, there are many strategies out there. I'll just say, again in September we're going to be getting a report from OSAC on the shared responsibility model. And, for those of you who aren't familiar with that model, it was developed a few years ago. It has been nationally recognized as, innovative. People point to Oregon and that model as a great way to go. But, unfortunately, over the years, that model has just not been able to work the way it was intended to. And the reason for that is because, on the one hand, the number of students who qualify for the grant has increased, because of the down economy. Uh-huh. Just families are struggling, but also the economy has driven more students to seek higher education, which is a good thing in moving us towards our 40-40 goal, but it means that the number of qualified students who cannot receive the opportunity grant diminishes year by year. And in addition, one of the assumptions was that tuition would be fairly stable, would not go up significantly over the years. But again, because we've not been funding the institutions at the level that they need just to maintain their current operations, more of the burden has had to be placed on the backs of students. We need to figure out a strategy to deal with that.
Chairperson Dimmer, members of the committee, I would, as one last comment, I would say that the value, the real value of this work, the work with identifying those barriers, working on strategies, I believe the real value will be that out of this will come more effective approaches, better planning than would happen without this work being done. So there's strong value, even if no additional funds come. They're still better off with this planning and work than they would have been without it. So we appreciate this opportunity.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for coming again.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Okay.
Good luck on your graduation.
Okay, the next item is the progress report on the Transfer Student Bill of Rights. Are you all ready to do that? Colleagues, in 2011, we passed the Transfer Student Bill of Rights. This came out of this committee. They have been working, and I think particularly on the issue of reverse transfer, which was one of the most exciting components, I think, of that bill, was a commitment to work on that. And so we're going to hear how that's going. Joe, you want to introduce yourself? Fair enough.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Holliday. I serve the Oregon University System as Assistant Vice Chancellor for Student Success Initiatives. And I'm going to start and then hand it to Elizabeth in just a minute. So, and as you said, Co-Chair Dembro, we have been working on the report for the Transfer Student Bill of Rights through the Unified Education Enterprise and the Joint Boards Articulation Committee and staff. You're looking at the staff. So we have a draft report that we'll be ready to deliver, we presume, to the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission on July 1st for them to pick up with it. So today, though, as you mentioned, we want to focus on reverse transfer, which is a piece of the work that we've been doing. And I'm going to hand it over to Elizabeth Brand to introduce that.
Representative Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Brand, Director of Communications and Research for the Community Colleges of Workforce Development. Commissioner Preuss would have been here today, but she was asked to go see the governor, so here I am in her stead. We have a fact sheet about reverse transfer that we had provided to the committee. So there is a little bit of information that you have about this, but just to bring you up to speed about what is reverse transfer. This is a program where a student who would transfer from a community college prior to receiving an associate degree, goes to a university, earns the appropriate credits at the university, can then transfer those credits back to the community college and be awarded the appropriate associate degree. So in essence, they are being awarded the degree that they've already earned after they've left the community college. Oregon first became interested in this last year. In September, there was a team of 11 representatives from the community colleges and from the Oregon University System that visited El Paso to look at an exemplary reverse transfer system. That is between El Paso Community College and the University of Texas, El Paso. They've been doing this for about 7 years and have a very nice model for which we were very happy to get a lot of information. After we got done with that trip, we came back. Joe and I wrote a recommendation letter to Dr. Andrews and Dr. Preuss recommending that we start some pilots here in Oregon. We took a look around the state, found some natural pilots that we have in our state, and so Joe's going to talk a little bit about our pilots that we've begun in Oregon.
Thanks, Elizabeth. So we have three pilot efforts currently underway. Earlier today, you were talking with President Davies about the Eastern Promise and the Eastern Oregon University and the two community colleges there, Blue Mountain and Treasure Valley, were the first to jump on board and say, we want to do this. Great spirit of collaboration. They're working on their pilot program. Oregon State University and Lynn Benton Community College are working on a pilot program. And a third one, which we're going to feature here and be brief about it, is Oregon Institute of Technology and Klamath Community College, because they've really taken it and run with it. The fourth partnership that we're bringing on as a result of a meeting last week is Rogue Community College and Southern Oregon University. So there's been a lot of interest in this and a lot of willingness to put some time aside to do this. So at this point, I'm going to introduce Wendy Peterson from Oregon Institute of Technology and John Duarte from Klamath Community College, who can tell you a little bit about the pilot program that they've launched in reverse transfer.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Dembro and members of the committee. I'm Wendy Peterson, for the record. I'm the University Registrar at Oregon Tech. And I just want to talk real briefly about why Oregon Tech was so willing to pilot this program with our partner, KCC. As many of you probably know, some of our engineering degrees, health sciences degrees, are very prescribed at Oregon Tech. So we often have students coming to us from the community college that have extra credits that really aren't applicable towards their degree. And so one of our desires partnering in this reverse transfer pilot program was to perhaps get these students to us a little bit earlier by allowing them to finish their associates while working on their bachelor's degree. And so I'm going to turn it over to my colleague and partner in this program, John Duarte. He'll tell you a little bit about KCC's intent and then some of the details about the program we've developed.
Okay. Good afternoon, Representative Dembro and members of the committee. I'm, for the record, I'm John Duarte. I'm the registrar at Klamath Community College. I appreciate this opportunity to participate in this hearing and present the beginning successes of the program between institutional and student successes that have already occurred between Oregon Tech and us here at KCC. First of all, institutional, we were needed to look at some of our policies that we felt hindered a student being able to obtain a degree in that were in place. This reverse transfer collaboration helped us move forward in this, and because of the reverse transfer collaboration, we actually did revise some policies that we found that hindered students from getting a degree. And so that was a very positive step forward. We've also, since we began this partnership, we've already awarded 3 degrees, associate degrees, at this point in time, and we're just getting started here. So it may not seem like a lot, but we're just starting to get going here, and it was very interesting to hear students starting to talk about it all of a sudden when they heard about a reverse transfer. On the student side of thing, I have specifically had conversations with students regarding getting their degree. It's positive in the sense that they've told me that they're getting this sense of accomplishment. You know, it was unsure how students would react, but I had several students call me right away saying, hey, I'd like to do this. What's it going to take? I want to be able to get this degree. One student in particular said, you know, I'm shooting forward to getting my bachelor's degree and going on, but in case something happens, at least I have this associate's degree that I can fall back on for future purposes. Those are student successes. We also, right now, currently, when I say we at KCC, I have 3 students who are in what we call pending status, for lack of better terms. They've indicated an interest, but we cannot confer their degree because they're still taking a few classes that they need to transfer back. So we have to wait to make sure that they pass the classes, which I'm sure they will. And all of this has, regarding to the 40-40-20, you know, this sort of collaboration just moves us forward in that direction.
Mr. Chair, can I ask?
Yes, Representative Krennic.
Excuse me, a little bronchitis problem. By transferring back, do you mean it comes out of the college credit line? I mean, you actually take 45 hours out of what would be an OIT credit and move it back to Klamath Community?
Representative Grin, let this make clarify it for you. And so John and I, in developing our program, came up with a certain set of criteria. So they must be currently enrolled at Oregon Tech. They have to have at least 90 credits to transfer back to grants. So KCC has the ability to grant that associates, and 24 of those credits must have been from KCC. And so what we're doing is the student is providing the transcript. We initially just sent out letters to a group of probably, that criteria got us about 95 students. So I mailed out letters to those students instructing them to contact John, and those students are providing those transcripts to John, and then John is running degree audits on each of them that is interested in seeing if they are eligible for the associate's degree through the community college.
Can I follow up?
Yes, please.
I mean, let's take 45 hours. Is it just he's recognizing them and saying, oh, yeah, you've done it, we'll give you the degree? Or do you literally, does it come out of the credit that they're building at OIT? I mean, they still have those 45 hours on there.
Yeah, they're lower division credits.
Correct.
That will.
So, Representative Grinlick, if I could expand a little bit, basically they're equivalent classes. So they complete them at OIT or Oregon Tech, and they bring them back to me, very much like them completing them at a community college and going up to a 4-year university. So I analyzed to verify that those classes are equivalent for the program or the major that the student had declared at that time.
So you're just checking them off. You're not taking them out of the OIT.
No.
That's what I was asking.
Oregon Tech.
Okay. Yeah. I understand.
Yeah. In the same way as if they had taken those credits at Klamath, then OIT would count them towards their 100 whatever.
Major or something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Representative Parker?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Cool. Yeah. See, you have to work for his approval. But once you have it, it's there.
So at some point, as we go a few years down this path that we're laying now, these students will have received associate's degrees and graduate's undergraduate degrees and perhaps graduate degrees. I want to be sure. I voted against 40-40-20. I'm trying to drink Kool-Aid here and be part of this. But my main goal is not 40-40-20. My goal is people coming out with educations that are going to produce jobs and that are going to yield a more sustainable, higher quality of life and economy in this state. So I want to be sure that we're not laying a system and laying groundwork for a system that establishes that that two different institutions have given a degree for the student who has done the work to get the bachelor's degree. Are we going to set up a system of double dipping in the reporting of the education of our young people and our not so young people who are going back to these institutions for more education to advance their quality of life? Help me, reassure me, please, okay?
Chair Jumbo, Representative Parker, members of the committee. One thing I'll say that might just provide some context is that 80% of our transfer students from community colleges eventually do earn their bachelor's degree, and so they've gone. They do go on. They graduate at higher rates than our native freshmen do. In fact,
understood.
So, and with reverse transfer, we think that'll even be. They won't have earned an associate's before transfer, but even after transfer, we believe it'll increase that percentage. So, most of them will earn a bachelor's degree. What we learned in Texas was that, number one, perhaps due to the fact that University of Texas at El Paso and El Paso Community College are both in the same city and very close and in the same community, their students find that the associate's degree pays immediate dividends because it helps them in the job market. Their students are working their way through college. So that associate's degree has a short-term benefit. Most of them are getting their bachelor's degree. They're also learning that the student that has the reverse transfer degree and the bachelor's degree has two different types of degrees sometimes, or two degrees that broaden their skills and their experience. So it's kind of like the undergraduate degree in a general area and a bachelor's degree, or and a master's degree, I'm sorry, in a specialized area. So it enhances their credentials. We believe it's going to help them in the long run as well. And we believe it'll help the economy grow as well.
And I will add to that that it also gives the individual a sense of satisfaction and pride, really, in having a degree. You know, there are so many people out there who have some college and they feel like failures, appropriately or not. I mean, that's just the reality. Having a degree matters. Representative Hunt?
Is there enough data after, I think you said it's just been 7 years in El Paso, is there enough data at this point that shows what for you is starting off at 80%, and may have started off at a different percentage with them? Is it already showing that percentage increasing, or is it too early after 7 years to have that kind of data?
And Elizabeth is nearby in case she wants to come up and help with that. But do you want to tackle that, Elizabeth?
Sure.
You stay right there.
Representative Hunt, when we talked with El Paso, the University of Texas, El Paso, they've begun to do that research, but you're right, it is a little too early. The preliminary results show that it is increasing their baccalaureate attainment for those particular students by about 10%. So, but it's a preliminary.
Okay. Representative Hunt.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any evidence or any indication that people are bailing on getting their bachelor's, having this available, meaning, oh, I've got my associates, it's good enough, I'm bailing, I'm running? When they're in their third year and just short of their bachelor, but that's as good enough, and so they're going to take it and run.
Representative Dembro, members of the committee, Representative Lindsay, actually it's the opposite. It is part of that launching forward that people are, El Paso is in particular. Students who have obtained the associate's degree then have that sense of completion. They have that sense of pride that Representative Dembro was mentioning, and that propels them forward to get the baccalaureate
degree.
But you
haven't seen that at all?
No, we have not. And this is, again, something similar to what Joe was just talking about. When you look at students who transfer, not all of them complete, and there are a lot of people that have some college and no degree. This is a way for a student to earn a degree that he or she has already earned. He or she has earned the credits for this degree. This is just a way of us recognizing that for the student.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. You know, the genesis of this aspect of the Transfer Student Bill of Rights came when we were when we had our special our committee, what was it called, the first committee on higher education that led to Senate Bill 242, we were hearing from some national experts that in terms of 40-40-20, the biggest gap in this state was in the middle 40. And I remember hearing that and thinking that, you know, I bet there are a lot of people who could be eligible for degrees there that, you know, if they could just claim the degrees for the work that they've already done. And, you know, I felt that this was a really creative idea, and I felt, you know, really brilliant, and like this was something I needed to get a patent for and all. And then, unfortunately, we heard about this El Paso, you know, had already started working.
Oh, God.
But, you know, so it goes. And it's great that we have a model with some experience. And I'm very excited that we're moving forward with this.
So, if I may give you a parting thought, Representative Dembro and, sure. and members of the committee. As Joe had mentioned, this is, with El Paso, they had mentioned to us that this is just one piece of many initiatives that they do. This is also one piece that we are doing here in Oregon. Along this same line, we are doing Win-Win, which I believe has been talked about, which is along this idea of the students have earned the degrees. They've just dropped out of the system prior to getting the degrees. So it's a matter of finding the students, contacting the students, and working with them to get them back so that they can get that degree that they've earned.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Just continuing our theme of student success and outstanding institutions, let's move to Portland Community College. Do I have to close the other one? All right, I'm going to close the discussion of the reverse transfer, the Transfer Student Bill of Rights, and open a discussion of Future Connect. How Portland Community College, the City of Portland, and the philanthropic community are partnering to support low-income, first-generation college students. Okay, congratulations, Mr. Wagner. I think this is the longest title we've ever had for a topic on this committee.
I, Chair Dembro, members of the committee, thank you very much for the plaudits on that. I worked very diligently with your committee administrator on coming up with such a brilliant title. She deserves at least half of the credit. So for the record, Rob Wagner, I'm the Government Relations Director for Portland Community College. And in interest of time, I'm going to keep my comments very limited because we have some folks here that are going to share some very unique perspectives after a one-year review of Future Connect, which is an innovative program. But I will set the policy context a little bit for this. PCC is dedicated to providing opportunities for student success to low-income, first-generation college students from across Multnomah County. And
President Pulliam's on my left. We'll talk about the vision and the history on this program and the development of the program. Josh Laurie, who's our program manager, will run through some slides on the particulars of the program from the first year cohort review. And then we'll hear, I think most importantly, from a student, a college success coach, and then a member of the foundation board, Chris Nielsen, about the efforts to leverage philanthropic and business support for the program and the efforts that they've put forward to put some real oomph behind the program. So here's a couple things that we know. One is something that you've all recognized, is that the future workforce in an era of global competition will require additional education and training. I think that's just Bob Davies was underscoring that, I think, in some of his testimony today. And another thing that we know, to quote a famous chair of this committee, having a degree matters. So from recent statistics, adults with an associate's degree, and this is from last year's National Center for Education Statistics, earns over $6,000 more per year over the course of their lifetime than a person with a high school diploma. And someone with a bachelor's degree earns an additional $9,000 with that degree. So I think it's an economic imperative for Oregon as well that we provide opportunity for students who didn't go to college. What else do we know? We know that not enough students are graduating. According to the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems, to remain globally competitive, the U.S. will need to produce 24 million additional degrees by 2025. And that is just to achieve a 60% degree attainment rate among adults ages 25 to 64. At the current attainment rates, if we don't do anything, the U.S. is on track to produce just around 280,000 additional degrees. So 24 million, we're on pace for an additional 280,000, which is a significant shortfall. So what else do we know? We know that here in Oregon, you have an even more aggressive goal to look at achievement in the future of education, which is going to require significant investment. I know that there was some discussion of that earlier, but it's also going to require targeting resources into program areas that maximize the chance for student success and to leverage public resources effectively. And I think most importantly, too, we can talk about statistics, but I think the lives that are impacted when you're looking at quality of life indicators or the students that you're going to hear from today about the chance to achieve the American dream, I think sometimes we kind of lose ourselves in the stats and we kind of forget the human element of all of this. So given that, to paraphrase something Representative Greenlick was saying earlier, we face some significant challenges. At PCC the last 4 years, we're serving 40% more students with 20% less money from the state. At the same time that expectations for outcomes are increasing, we get almost half as much money per full-time student as we did 4 years ago. So this leads us to Future Connect, which is a visionary program that builds on national best practices and that leverages many partnerships, regional, business, our local K-12 community, to improve college access and completion for low-income first-generation college goers. This is our first attempt at having the conversation with the state, but I did want to pause and thank Representative Dembro, Representative Wingard, Representative Parrish, Representative Frederick, and others who were at the PCC Gala on Saturday night celebrating 50 years of our institution, where we raised several $100,000 to support Future Connect going forward. So it was a grand success. With that, I'll introduce Dr. Preston Pulliams, president of Portland Community College, who really had the vision for the program and was the focal figure who built all those partnerships with all our local stakeholders.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, and to the committee. My name for the record is Preston Pulliams. I'm district president of Portland Community College, and I'm here for two objectives. The first is to tell you just some brief highlights about this program, and staff will talk about details. And the second, to pick up a very large check from Representative Dembro on part of our gala. Did I surprise you, sir, about this?
I wouldn't have been there.
That was my wife.
But really, thank those of you who attended. It was a great event.
Yeah, and let me just add, a week ago, the governor issued a proclamation making last Tuesday PCC Day,
in celebration of the 50 years that it's been in existence. A very happy week for Portland Community College.
Yeah. Thank you for your support, Mr. Chairman, about that process, too. You all know pretty much about our mission, I'm sure, in terms of all the community colleges across the state. It is about access. It is about open door. It is about often giving individuals opportunities for access to higher education that may have no other route because of finances, et cetera. This program is about really not just getting students into college and them having access, but it's also about what I think is a very innovative model to have them finish, complete, and be successful and move on and eventually be competitive in the job market. This program is built off best practices, so this is just not an experiment in sense of we're going to try some things. We have been fortunate over my tenure at Portland Community College, before my time, a number of innovative programs, and we know from those efforts what strategies work. And basically, as I see it, to put it simply, it's not just about getting money or scholarships or grants to get in college or to pay for books or fees. Many students are challenged also not about what's going on in the classroom, but they're challenged about their lives outside the classroom. And so the uniqueness of this program is we also provide coaching and mentoring and support alongside their classroom activities. And I think that's a distillation of some great practices throughout the country, but we really focus it, laser focus it in this program. It is a combination of financial support. It is a combination of a intensive individual advising support for our students. The origin of the program actually happened several years ago. I sat on the education cabinet of the mayor, Sam Adams, of the city of Portland, and the conversation came up, how could the city engage with the issue about students, not enough students going to college, and also not enough really graduating from the area high schools. And the first idea was, let's put on the table some dollars to support this effort so students will have some financial support. But as we engaged in the discussion, and we decided that it should be 360 degrees in terms of comprehensive support. It's not just about the dollars, but it is about the coaching and mentoring. What also is great about this program is that it's a leveraging of funds in terms of the college has made an investment. Also, the city of Portland has set aside now $360,000, and they challenged our foundation to match that dollar for dollar. So our PCC foundation raised $360,000 to match the mayor's contribution, or the city's contribution, and along with that, we raise now quite a bit of additional dollars through working with local foundations, particularly business and industry, who are making contributions to this effort. So it features, in this sense, three things that I think are critical in this type of program, particularly with diminished resources in today's situations. One, engagement, broadening the table, so we have more coming to the table, just the schools. Also, partnerships, because we're partnering with the city, businesses, foundations, and also with others who are making, individuals who are making substantial contributions to the program. The engagement, collaboration, and the innovative part of it is where we are working with the coaching and mentoring. This program is scalable. We just started. We have approximately 150 students in it at this point. Our goal is to, next cohort will come on next year for another same amount, so we hope to have 300 students. But the exciting part is because of the success of our program already, we're getting approached by individuals and municipalities from around our metropolitan area, including Washington County and others, who are very interested and want to work with us in this project. So I want to turn over now to the staff to make a few comments.
Chair Dembro, representatives of the committee, for the record, my name is Joshua Laurie. Good afternoon. I'm the manager of the Future Connect Scholarship Program at Portland Community College, and I'm lucky enough here to sit in front of you and present about the program that we've been running for just a little bit over a year now. It's quite exciting, and I feel lucky to be part of it. So we start with this sentence here: for every 10 Multnomah County students who enter high school, 6 will graduate, 4 will go to college, and 2 will complete. For us, we're really focused on that last number. This program is not just about access, but success. And our job is to increase that last number. How we do that, I'm going to cover several different facets of the program, from eligibility to supports and even funding, and then our current cohort. I will try to do that succinctly, and I bit tangential at times, as my students tell me, so I'm going to utilize this to keep me on track. Oops, there you go. So first, let's talk about eligibility. Oh, we'll go back. I apologize. Everyone see that? Eligibility in the broadest sense is really focused on first-generation and low-income students. For us, we're focused on these students in two areas of Portland, mainly Northeast, North Portland, and Deep Southeast, South Portland. But we serve the entire district, Portland Community College campuses. For us, we also work in conjunction with Summer Youth Connect programming. So it's not just about reaching out to students who are about to graduate, but it's about reaching out to students in that 8th to 9th grade transition, 10th to 11th grade, 11th to 12th. And we do that in a myriad of ways. The Summer Youth Connect programming works out, and it's targeted interventions for students who are off track either by attendance or grades. And what happens is, for instance, this summer we're bringing out 13 groups of these ninth graders who are transitioning to ninth grade to the college, and I'm going to meet with them. And I'm going to talk about the scholarship and the program 4 years ahead of time. These are students who otherwise would be pre-contemplative about college. And the idea is to begin talking about college to students to help them become contemplative about this. And every summer we'll do the same thing. And then in the senior year, we start working on them in terms of applying for the scholarship. So eligibility is first generation and low income, but eligibility also means about getting to students early on in their high school career.
Josh, when you say first generation, you mean first generation attenders of college?
Exactly. Their parents did not attend college.
Okay, just a sec. Rep. Lindsay?
I was just going to ask, how do you determine that, and how do you determine low income? How do you define low income?
Chair Denbrough, Representative Lindsay, we do that through a scholarship application. We also get to know the students individually as their senior begins. So we're embedded or nested in all the high schools and alternative schools within Multnomah County. So we do that just not through a questionnaire or a FAFSA application that reports EFC, which is estimated family contribution, but also through getting to know them and their families. So we do questionnaires, we do interviews. It's quite intimate, I should say.
Right. Are you wondering what the actual threshold is? Or just the methodology?
The threshold, I guess, too.
A typical EFC that we look at for low income for this scholarship is around twice the estimated family contribution for the cost of tuition, books, and fees at Portland Community College, which is about $10,000. The average EFC right now across the nation is around $1,800, I'd say. The majority of our students that come into our program have an EFC of zero. Excellent. So supports, for us, it all starts with the mentoring and the relationship. So we utilize college success coaches. And the college success coaches are nested inside the alternative high schools and the mainstream high schools within Multnomah County. So we work with college and career transition coordinators or counselors at each program. And we begin working with students above and beyond just those who might apply for the scholarship. So a big piece of what we do is provide resources for financial aid literacy, FAFSA, and kind of that language of college that exists in terms of navigating the chasm between high school and college. So while we do intend to work with 200 applicants this year, we've actually already reached out and worked with over 600 students residually just through our efforts. So it's a program that's already doing much more than we intended. The college success coach works with them in the high school, begins to develop a caseload, student applies, and then we work with them over the course of the summer. So students would actually go through a summer bridge program with us that included an orientation on the campus. And then the beautiful part of this program is that the college success coach then both teaches classes to the students their first term on campus. So they're not only the ones who are working with them and coaching them in how to access college, but they're also the first ones who are doing instruction. And I'll speak to that instruction in a second.
Yeah.
Right now, our staffing is quite basic. We have 5 positions that are spread throughout all the schools and within the college itself. Summer bridge activities that I mentioned, these are key because we feel persistence is a major issue for individuals who are first-generation college students. They often graduate, say they're going to go to college, and then fall through the cracks. So what we try and do is stay in touch with them through about 10 different summer bridge activities. Right now, we have 4 specific orientation days where students come out and follow through with an intense day that kind of wrap services around them to really describe what they're going to experience as an incoming freshman student. It's more than just an orientation or an overview of what it looks like, but we go through a very specific cultural experience for them. and the cohort-style CG classes. At PCC, we have several college and survival classes. We offer two free classes to all Future Connect scholarship recipients. These are taught by the college success coaches that they've been working with at high school. So that transition from high school to college is almost seamless. They've built a relationship with their mentor, they've worked with them over summer, and now they're the first person they work with on campus. And we follow them for up to 3 years should they stay enrolled at PCC.
And CG stands for?
College Survival, College Guidance. And we do two of those classes, and I think it's important to focus on not just the first one, which is college survival, but the second one, which is today's careers. And today's careers help students explore what career they want to do, and I'll speak to that in a little bit in terms of how we tie that into career connectivity. Finally, and I mentioned scholarship money last, even though it's in the name of the program, I think it's the hook for many people. They see scholarship and they think we're giving students money, but the reality is that the supports that I just spoke of kind of helps scholarship money that we provide. We know that money is important, but more importantly, it's buttressing that money with actual supports that are going to tie into it. And these students receive a minimum of $600 per year as long as they go to PCC for up to 3 years. So right off the top, if a student is in a transfer set to go to PSU, let's say in 2 years, even 2.5 years, they're looking at an $1,800 bump on top of whatever they're receiving. Right now, our program goals are simple. We're looking at four main goals of progression, career connection, retention, and completion. And I want to say that we're hitting all of these goals with the exception of one, and that is the career connection. Our goal is to have 95% of our students go through two career connectivity activities, connection activities, I should say, and right now we're at 90%. So while that seems like we're not there, I'm excited because this summer we have 19 internships set up with the bureaus in the city. And those internships are 400 hours, $10 an hour. They only run the summer, and they're all connected to the student's first year academics coursework. So what we're doing is we're working with students to become contemplative, not just about their academics, but also about the career choices that they're starting to work on academically, and then connect that to their internships. So they'll go off, potentially, if someone's interested in, let's say, AutoCAD, they might apply for an internship at the Water Bureau, have 25 credits of classes, two in AutoCAD, go do an internship over the course of the summer, and then come back reinvigorated for that second year of academics that's connected to something they just did. And they have a real-world, authentic experience to connect to that. That's a big piece of the program, and I bring that up here because while I can say we're not hitting the career connection, I feel
that's
confident
pretty close.
That we'll get there after the summer. Our current, we'll go here. So currently, 95% of the students we're working identify as first generation. 70% of the students identify as students of color. And we have 114 students currently enrolled, which is a 75% retention rate from fall to now. Our goal is 70% from fall to fall. And there's statistics that show that this rate for the same demographic is around 27%. So, and statistically, for the average PCC student, we're around 54%, I believe, from fall to fall retention. So we're above and beyond that. We're still focused on the students we leave, though, that leave us, and we stay connected to them in hope to retain them. Now, as I mentioned, 19 internships we have, and since fall, we've provided $75,000 worth of scholarships for these students. Every year, we're actually going to enroll 200 students. And the scholarship and the program has become so successful out in the schools that we have created a wait list. So we had over 310 students apply this year. And one of the differences that we did this year, it's obviously a new program, is that we created a wait list. Students, for a variety of reasons, when they graduate, decide to do other things. As much as I think college is important, I think students are also just, they have to go work sometimes, and they can't follow through with this. So they'll contact us and say, hey, I can't go to PCC. Thanks for the opportunity. Last year, we didn't have spots available. This year, we have a wait list of up to 45 students waiting to fill that spot. So when we say 200, we're going to work with 200. All of those students we're currently working with now, regardless if they're on the wait list or not. And since then, we've actually worked with over 600 students this year. And what our feedback from school staff is that they really appreciate having that counselor, that advisor, out in the high schools doing kind of this free contemplative advising, and even specific advising about the system of college that they need to be aware of before they even leave. So how do we pay for all this? Dr. Pulliam spoke to this briefly, but I'm just going to put it in a simple visual here, that the City of Portland currently funds about half of this $775,000 cohort cost. That's for about 2 years. With that, PCC and the PCC Foundation match the city's funds for each of these cohorts, and 40% of that budget is scholarships. So in a nutshell, that's kind of my overview of the program, where we've come in a year from eligibility to support and funding.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Did I miss the question? What's their average GPA out of high school of students coming into this?
Well, we work with students. Not all of our students have a GPA. We also work with students who come from alternative programs that have a GED. So I couldn't tell you kind of aggregate data over the course of all of these students.
Let me, if I may, ask the question differently. Are these students coming out of high school and their cohorts have above average grades or below average grades or a mixture of those? I mean,
Chair Dembro, Representative Greenlick, above average. It's a scholarship program, and the idea of the program is that students test into no more than one developmental ed course in college. So we work closely with the testing and the kind of the placement testing of PCC. However, we've developed tracks, and what we're finding is that it's more important for us to be a conduit for students who are even testing into developmental ed. So we're not turning any students away. What we're doing is finding the right track that that student might fit in and then helping support them so they feel like there's, we're basically trying to put a face to the name. PCC is a large institution. For these students, they need a little bit extra.
Thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Just sure.
Other questions? Okay, let's hear from the front line. If we could.
Thank you. We'll be here if there's any additional
great
questions around policy or things that we can get you.
Thank you very much, Rob. Okay, so we have Becca Moyer, Jenny Chai, Chris Nielsen. Go in the order you feel is best.
Do you want to start there?
I certainly can.
That's up to you.
Co-Chair Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Christine Nielsen. I am the incoming chair of the Portland Community College Foundation. The commitment of the foundation is to remove financial barriers that prevent students from staying in college. And as we know, finances is often the number one reason that a student will leave college. We're also committed to raising funds that open the door for students who might not even think of going to college. We're committed to funding the Future Connect program. We want to make sure that the existing program is stable, and we want to see the program expand throughout our district. We recently, as you heard, held our very successful fundraising gala, raising more than $300,000. Part of the reason I would say that we support this program so strongly is because not only do we recognize the devastating effects on young people to not have the kind of future that college allows them to have, but we see the effects on the economy. We see the effects in our local community of that lost potential. So our foundation board has owners and upper-level management from local and national businesses such as Platt Electric, Vestas, Integra Telecom, Hillsborough Aviation, Madden Industrial Craftsman, Tuolity Health Systems, Columbia Industries, to name a few. Our family business, Nielsen Manufacturing, relied heavily on the community college as the pipeline for qualified employees, whether they be employees in the trades or employees in who had gone on to four-year institutions. And so that, for me, is a fundraiser, which is chiefly what I am as the member of the foundation board, makes this a wonderful story to tell. When I meet with a business person, when I talk with someone who understands what I've just said to you and understands the success that the program has to offer, it's amazing how that really often leads to quick thinking about support. The fact that it's also supported by the City of Portland and what they're doing is matching dollars also makes a good fundraising story. But the reality is, the foundation can never raise enough money to replace what the state could offer to a program like this. We know that to grow this to not only the district locations where it should be, but to the students who could benefit from it, is just an enormous financial undertaking. We're committed to work real hard to get this to as many students as we can, but the state could really be a wonderful partner with us, and we would love to have that happen.
Thank you very much, Chris, and thank you for your service, you know, at the Foundation Board. I'm sure that your salary is not all that great.
It's been doubled.
Thank you for your work. Becca?
Yes, Chair Dumbro, representatives of the committee. My name is Rebecca Moyer, for the record, and I'm a college success coach at Portland Community College. I began working at PCC about 1 year ago now. I've been working with high-risk youth for 7 years now, and it's such a privilege to work at PCC. It's wonderful working with first-generation low-income college students and seeing the success that we've seen, particularly just in individual students. There are so many stories I could share, but I have but one student in particular to share her story. So as Josh said, the Future Connect program does not start when students enroll at PCC. Rather, it starts way before that, when students are still in high school. We go out to the high schools, work with students, work with counselors, help them transition. College really does not make sense, especially for first-generation students. Thinking that you have to fill out financial aid 1 year in advance, that you have to purchase your books, they have to register for classes 3 months in advance. These aren't things that come naturally for students, particularly if they're the first in their families to attend college. So as a coach, we work with students individually and develop that relationship and make sure this transition is smoother. As Josh also mentioned, we teach several classes so that students can have the skills necessary to be successful in college and also explore careers that open up to them with a college degree. I think really, as Josh said again, that the scholarship is not the biggest part of this. It's really the relationships that we can develop, and having a caring adult in a young person's life, I think, is vital to success. So today, we have Jenny here today. She is just an exceptional young woman. She currently has a 4.0 at PCC and aspires to be either a counselor or social worker, so something in social services. And actually, luckily, her sociology teacher gave her the day off today to be here to speak with all of you. So I'm going to turn it over to Jenny to tell you a little bit about her story.
Hello, Representative Dembro and fellow committees. My name is Jenny Chow, and I'm a current student at PCC. This is my third term, and I'd like to start off and say that I'm very fortunate. Although my parents, they don't speak English, they graduated from high school. And like me, everybody on my dad's side graduated from Roosevelt High School in North Portland. I'm a first-year generation college student from a low-income family. I've been lucky that my parents have always encouraged me to go to college, despite never going themselves. My Portland Community College tuition is paid through the Pell Grant, but I have a scholarship. I was awarded the Future Connect Scholarship in the fall of 2011. For me, it's a special scholarship that helps push me for achievement. When I left high school, I was worried of being alone in college. I was scared not having someone help guide me like I did in high school. Without the scholarship, I would not have had a head start of building connections in college. Through Future Connect, I took two college successful classes with fellow scholarship recipients. These classes taught me time management, test-taking skills, how to develop connections, and to be more involved in the community. Without the scholarship, I would not have met an incredible advisor. My Future Connect advisor helps me in various ways to prep me for my degree in social work. She has helped tutor me and always encouraged me in achieving greatness. I'm fortunate. However, not everybody's story is like mine's, but it can be. Through the Future Connect Scholarship, students can gain confidence from their fellow scholarship peers and advisors so they can enjoy the wonderful journey of college like I am. I'm fortunate to have been applied for the scholarship and to have accepted into the scholarship program, and most importantly, I'm fortunate to be part of the Future Connect family. With this Future Connect Scholarship, I discovered that college is achievable, that connections are essential, and therefore I'm succeeding for these students who need a scholarship for the future. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Rick Lindsay?
Thank you for coming to testify. That's great to see your positive attitude and being grateful. That's great. For a college coach, I actually had a friend that was a college coach for a while, and it's amazing the story they had to tell me. I just have a question, because I think maybe for the two of you, because you might have a little bit more current knowledge on that, on this question I'm going to ask, and that is, when I was in college, there were several of my friends that came out seriously about five times as much debt as I did. Mm-hmm. And I'm a penny pincher. They were not. And oftentimes I was thinking, you're crazy. You're taking out all this debt. And I think some of the statistics are is that the government, at least the federal government, owes more education debt than like home mm-hmm. loans. What are you seeing as to the debt loads that students are taking on? Do you see abuse of debt? Do you see them taking on unnecessary debt? Are there alarm bells going everywhere, or do you think it's just tuition?
So Representative Lindsay and members of the committee. I guess to answer that question, it does depend on the student. I would say that the large majority of our students at PCC in the Future Connect program do not have to take out loans. There are some students who do need to do that. It's based on their circumstances. We do have some students who are homeless. We also have parenting youth, so they need to provide a roof over their heads and food for their children. So sometimes it is necessary for them to take out loans. I'd say on my own personal caseload, I have about 60, and I would say 5 to 10 have taken out loans, so a smaller number than, for sure, bachelor's degree programs. I think also with the Future Connect program, Josh spoke a little bit about the partnerships that we've been developing, but the Renaissance Foundation is one foundation that's recently granted us at least 10, possibly 15 scholarships for students to transfer on to bachelor's degree programs. So that will award them $3,000 each year at a bachelor's degree institution. So with the Pell Grant and that, they probably can escape without any debt instead of the $25,000 that's the average for a bachelor's degree at this point.
Well, thank you, but let me just rephrase the question.
Yes,
do you see a lot of unnecessary debt being taken out? Do you see that?
I do not see that, no.
You don't see that?
Mm-mm. I could say maybe at a four-year institution that could be the case, but Portland Community College is very affordable. It's $85 a credit. So with the Pell Grant, which all of our students qualify for the Pell Grant. I don't see that. I can't speak for the general PCC population, but I could speak for the Future Connect program, I feel.
And Ms. Cha?
Representative Lindsay and the fellow committees. For me, I try to avoid taking loans as much as possible because I know my parents, they're unemployed. So I know that for me to get through to college, it's all on me and for applying for scholarships. And some people I know, they have to take out loans, but personally for me, I try to avoid as much as possible, but saying that I am going to have to transfer to PSU, I might have to take out loans, and for that purpose, it's just for my education.
Yeah, and if I can just add to that, one of the things that the Student Success Task Force has found is that students who come from backgrounds that are not familiar with college, often they're from populations that are very reluctant to take out loans in general. A lot of immigrant, communities are very, very reluctant to go down that road. And so that's one of the barriers, actually, that people trying to increase the attendance rates of Latino students, face, is there's reluctance to take on debt. And, part of it is, just the family situation, and the other part just, just...
Smarts.
Well, maybe, but... certainly we have to figure out a way to keep that debt load low, and this program seems to be one of the ways to do that. Other comments? Yes. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nice to hear from all of you and the previous panel, too. Chris, thank you so much for stepping up and helping out with this. I'm sure it was a long conversation and probably a lengthy thought process before committing to doing something. But what you're talking about is the private sector and the business community recognizing the importance of producing trained people and the positive impact that it's going to have on the community as a whole. And I think there's a lot of evidence that this is going on right now. If you look at the Portland STEM Alliance and the funding that's being put into that by Intel and other organizations, not meaning to pick out Intel and slight any others, but I think there is widespread recognition right now that while it would be wonderful if the state could chip in more money, the state is not going to chip in significantly more money right now. We've been here long enough to see it decline. I've only been here during the 4 years that we've seen this decline that was mentioned earlier on. We wish we could throw more money at it, and these people here, and others are fighting to do so. But in the absence of that money, it's wonderful to see the business community stepping up and trying to help you folks who are in the trenches all the time forge these partnerships and get us through this somehow. Because I think that the type of connections that this program is building are really wonderful for students to see, that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, that there is good debt compared with bad debt, and that sometimes taking out loans to get through college is something that's going to pay off really well. So thanks to all of you for helping put this together. I don't have a question, just a comment.
No, that's great. And I would just add to that, thanks to the city of Portland, you know, for stepping up. It's, you know, a great commitment on their part, and I think a smart one. If, you know, looking to saving future costs and increasing the future tax base, you know, for the city of Portland. Jenny, I just one question. So one component of the program is that you sort of pay back by being a peer mentor, a peer tutor, you know, for future students. So, is that something you're looking forward to?
Yes, I am looking forward to being a mentor to people who be like a role model that, you know, because of the scholarship, I could succeed, and that you could do the same too. And I've always had that. That's why I want to be a social worker, to help people and to inspire them, to motivate them not to fall through the cracks.
Great, thank you. Okay, thank you all very much for coming and talking to us. Okay, so I'll close this this session on Future Connect and open up the final topic, which is just to present to you a progress report on the Special Committee on University Governance. Colleagues, you'll remember that in February we passed House Bill 4061, which created the Special Committee on University Governance. That committee has been meeting. Actually, we've had four meetings since it was statutorily required to be formed by the middle of March. And it's good we put that deadline on because that caused it to happen. Just to quickly tell you the members of the committee, we have three co-chairs for this committee, the blessings of shared governance. But we have Reps Johnson and I are co-chairs from the House side, and Senator Haas from the Senate side. Representatives Hoyle and Springer are also on the committee, as are Senators Beyer, Girard, and Morse. We also have, as stipulated by the legislation, two members of the Oregon Education Investment Board, and those are Matt Donegan, who also serves as the chair, the president of the State Board of Higher Ed, and Kay Turan, who had a long career with Human Services and DHS, and is currently, what does she do?
Volunteers
of America. She's their director. Most notably, we have the able support and assistance of Victoria Cox, who is our administrator for the committee. And so that's why we were able to get four meetings in already in this short time. Dana Richardson, who was very active in the previous iteration, the previous higher ed committee, is also has been helping us. Provided you with some handouts. There have been a lot of handouts in this committee. And, you know, if you want to know more, I would encourage you to go to the website for the committee. Victoria has set up a website for the task force.
Mike
has? All right, that's right. There's a lot of information on there. All the handouts are made available there. And what I've presented, prepared for you for today are, you know, first of all, the charge of the committee, the timeline. The timeline is a very interesting document that looks at how, over the years, this issue of university governance has been addressed by the State Board of Higher Ed and by the legislature. So that was also something that Dana put together, along with some of the initial questions that we're going to need to get resolved as we work through these issues. While the committee was being formed, the State Board of Higher Education's Governance Committee has also been looking into this issue of university governance. And they, by the time of our second meeting, and certainly by our third meeting, they had completed work on their recommendation, their meaning the State Board's Governance Subcommittee, recommendation about what an institutional board might look like according to a number of different parameters. If we did have institutional boards, that is, if institutions wanted them and were to be granted institutional boards, what powers could be devolved to those boards and what powers would be reserved to the State Board of Higher Ed? And one of the handouts that you have...
Assumes there is going to be a State Board of Higher Ed?
It does.
It does assume
they
that.
Do, yes. Here you have their recommendations of how things should be divided up. Those recommendations were applauded by that subcommittee's chair, Paul Kelly, who was the former president of the State Board. And just speaking editorially, I really applaud the work that they've done in, anticipating interest in institutional boards and making recommendations up front. You will see these here. We have also heard testimony from the interim president at the University of Oregon, Bob Berdahl, as well as Portland State University's president, Vim Vivel. Both of those institutions are interested, as you know, in having institutional boards, and they shared with us their vision of what such boards would look like and why they think we should come up with a model that allows for that. In your packet, you have the vision that the University of Oregon is looking at. It's encapsulated in this diagram, this sort of Venn diagram, where you have the powers of this state entity, whether it's the State Board of Higher Ed or the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission or something, and then the University of Oregon Board, and then shared authorities. We also got from Portland State University, looked at the charges of the task force that are laid out in 4061, and looked at the recommendations made by the State Board of Higher Ed and their response to those. Okay, so these are also things that you can, that you can look at to bring yourself to keep current with the work of the committee. Just, the timeline of the committee's work is the statute requires us to come up with a recommendation by the middle of August, an initial recommendation, which will then go out into the field. We anticipate taking it to universities and universities around the state, areas around the state, to get feedback. And then we will come to this committee during September days. The plan is to have our committee days in September be a joint meeting with the Senate to look at that recommendation and to, for us to give feedback to it. The ultimate recommendation, if it's a statutory one, needs to be done by the middle of November. And then we will, in an ideal world, have consensus or near consensus from the task force and support from the two committees, and we'll be able to move forward on it. I neglected to say that at our last meeting, which was just yesterday, the governor also came and shared his vision as well as two of the regional presidents, President Weiss, Interim President Weiss from Western Oregon, and President Bob Davies from Eastern Oregon. One of the things that the legislation requires us to do is to consult with all the university presidents and to make sure that whatever system we come up with that we recommend does not have an adverse impact on the universities that are not asking for boards, or at least to mitigate those impacts. At our next meeting, which will be on June 7th, we'll be hearing from someone from the Treasurer's Office. One of the issues out there is, you know, to what extent should institutional boards be able to do revenue bonds or other kinds of bonds? And, you know, there are some differences of opinion around that. We want to have a clear sense from the Treasurer's Office of what we should be watching out for, what we should be careful of, what opportunities are out there, et cetera. So I look forward to that presentation. We'll also be hearing from President Maples of OIT. We'll be sharing his vision. And then we'll also be hearing from President Ed Ray from Oregon State University at a future meeting. I think that's about it. We, you know, we've been looking at some of the other models that are out there around the country. The nation is split, you know, between systems that are centrally organized and those that have institutional boards. One of the models that has generated some degree of interest is the model in North Carolina. North Carolina has a kind of hybrid model where there are institutional boards and also a state board, and they have very carefully divided up the authorities of, you know, the institutional boards, which have the advantage of being on the ground close to the institutions, and then a statewide board, which, you know, covers governance issues that are going to be more global in nature. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Representative Greenlee.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Has there been any discussion at all of my proposal to have PSU and OHSU end up under the same board?
There's been no direct, I think there have been some references to it, actually. And let me just jump in that, you know, one of the other issues that's out there is to what extent we should be emulating or not the system at OHSU, which has a very independent kind of board, and you know, that I think it will be an ongoing topic of conversation.
Is there any chance to, as I've asked, I'll ask again, is there any chance to insert into that discussion a serious consideration of the advantages of having those two institutions in the Portland metropolitan area governed by the same board? I mean, if not, I'd like to find a way to insert some of that into it.
Okay. Well, you know, we had the presentation from President Bivel. I actually wasn't able to be at that meeting, or I might well have asked that question, actually, on your behalf. But it's, you know, I think it's something that people are certainly aware of. And I'm not sure if President Bivel talked about the growing partnerships, you know, between the two institutions.
There is a, I mean, they have, at the request of the Education Committee from the 09 session, created a task force to look at these things and have a, I think, an ambitious program of shared activities. But my impression is that it's never going to get off the ground in any real way unless they have the same governing board to break down those interinstitutional barriers. And what I'm worried about, and I've talked to both President Bivel and the governor in the last 2 weeks about, that if an institutional board is established in Portland that's separate and therefore creates its own turf and its own environment, it'll hinder the possibility of creating shared ventures rather than help it. And I've stopped talking about merging the institutions anymore, but I really do think having them under the same board really will foster the development of education resources we need in the metropolitan area. And I would just hope they would stop laughing at that, and I'd answer the question of what the mascot should be like. It should be a Viking in a white coat and things like that, and seriously think about the needs of, not the needs of the state system, but the needs of higher ed in the metropolitan area, which has its own, excuse me, its own dimension, its own importance for the economic development of that area.
Thank you. Yes, I'll make sure that's put on the agenda.
Thank
Representative.
You.
There, yes, Representative.
It sounds like there's probably has been and will continue to be a lot of focus on issues around institutional boards. In terms of the, do you envision coming back with specific recommendations looking at the OEIB, the HEC, and the Board of Higher Ed, and ending up with one or two or some number less than
some
three?
I'm
trying
to get it up to five.
Did you envision that being part of the recommendations of
yes.
how to...
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. That is another aspect of the charge
oh,
of the
really?
Committee. Yes, is to look at, you know, the statewide governance. And we have a parallel process that's going on within the OEIB. The governor has asked the OEIB also to look at, you know, issues of central governance. Not only for higher ed, but also for K-12, and to you know, looking at potential board consolidation, just coming up with a set of recommendations. And the plan is to have the work of that committee feed into the work of the task force, so that ideally by the end of the summer, early fall, we can come up with some kind of consolidated plan that will then become part of the legislative agenda for 2013. We'll see. It's that, you know, in some ways, the issue of statewide governance is going to be trickier, actually, than institutional governance. But the two really go hand in hand, I think. And so we have been talking about both simultaneously. But, you know, I think we're going to try to really come to a place get to a certain point with institutional boards, and then you know, move into the statewide governance and come up with something that is really looking at both at the same time. Anything else, people, that you think we should be looking at as we're, I mean, you hear what we've been doing so far, and anything that you think we should be doing as part of the process?
Well, you've been leaning on the oars these 4 months since you started, 3 months since you started. You've only had four meetings.
We're meeting every 2 weeks. We're trying to keep the meetings focused and just like 2 hours long. You know, I think we have about four or five more meetings on the agenda. And it's hard work, but it's important.
I'll just throw in, if I may, that I think his suggestion and his request for inserting that discussion about PSU and OHSU in there is...
About the mascot?
No. Bad man. Is worthy of discussion.
Thank you.
It could just be that we both have PhDs from the University of Michigan that makes us think so...
The university what,
such wacky
school.
Thoughts.
Yeah.
Okay. Hearing no questions, I'm going to bring to an end this part of the agenda. And since this is the last item on the agenda, I'll close this meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education. Thank you all for your interest in it.
For the record, 30 minutes early.